The plan was to do a whole sweep of the Four Noble Truths, and little did I know that that can be challenging to do sometimes. Speak succinctly about the Four Noble Truths. So I'm going to do my best tonight to keep everything pretty succinct. We'll do a review of the First Noble Truth and just give you a sweep of the Four Noble Truths. So we entered into exploration, like a deep, not deep, but an experiential exploration of the Four Noble Truths through a simile and a teaching that was offered by Sariputta. And Sariputta was one of the Buddha's foremost disciples. I love reminding myself that Sariputta was called the mother who brings forth. So he helped people move into a direct experience of stream entry. He brought people forth, spiritual seekers, into this a moment of freedom where you see the Dhamma and you have an understanding that whatever arises ceases. And it's so easy to say, right? But to actually have a deeply felt experience of that. That leads to a lessening of craving is quite profound. So he was known as the mother who brought forth. And he created a simile, this image of the Four Noble Truths. So just a reminder, he said, friends, just as the footprint of any living being that walks can be placed within an elephant's footprint. And so the elephant's footprint is declared the chief of them because of its great size. So too, all wholesome states can be included in the Four Noble Truths. So all wholesome states can be included in the Four Noble Truths. And this was such a revelation to me because I never thought of the Four Noble Truths as containing all the wholesome. And through that, they started to feel full of compassion and warmth. And really in my own exploration around the Four Noble Truths right now, the practice is just, it's where the heart is wanting to tend to, and it's been really rich, and they're just full of compassion. So when we turn to the Four Noble Truths, we're actually starting to relate to them as broad enough and deep enough to contain all of the wholesome. And the venerable what's it, the venerable Anālaya, the venerable Sariputta continues in the sutta by defining each of the Four Noble Truths. So in this passage, I changed the word suffering to dukkha, the Pali that's translated as suffering. And Sariputta says, in what form? In the noble truth of dukkha. In the noble truth of the origin of dukkha. In the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha. And in the noble truth of a way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So if you remember last week, brought in this image of a plant or a tree or the leaves of a tree, troping to what's wholesome, troping to the light, troping to that which is life-affirming. And that when we start to really engage experientially with the Four Noble Truths, the heart is starting to trope towards these four basic actions. Like the heart is moving in the direction of these four basic actions. So with the First Noble Truth, we're learning to understand dukkha. And it's a in the bones, in the marrow understanding. It starts with an intellectual understanding. But when we start to actually engage the stuff of our lives with this First Noble Truth, it moves from here down into the heart. And with this First Noble Truth, it's to be understood. How it becomes alive is in recognizing Let's see, I want to get the words right. The revelation of what dukkha is, in the words of Rupert Gethin. And this is a very profound, very simple but profound practice. Because when we're in our lives, we usually get so caught up in the content. We don't have enough perspective to step back and just say, honey, this is dukkha. And just learning to breathe with it. Breathe with any reactivity that we're having around that dukkha so that it can actually be understood. So, this first noble truth, what we're troping toward is understanding dukkha. Second noble truth, the origin of dukkha, which is craving, is just to be abandoned. And I say just as if it's something really simple. It's not, because the roots of craving run very, very deeply. And to actually be able to let go of craving is predicated on a deep trust, in our capacity to actually be with the reality of dukkha as it is without our reactivity, without our wish for reality to be other than it is. And that takes trust and a deep knowing that we have the capacity, our hearts have the capacity to be with the direct bare experience of dukkha. So with the third noble truth, the cessation of dukkha is to be realized. It's to be realized, it's to be made real. And with the fourth noble truth, the path leading to the cessation of dukkha is to be developed. So we'll move into the second noble truth. And the second noble truth does concern dukkha, but it's of a different nature than the dukkha of the first noble truth. So this isn't the dukkha of what the later commentaries they named, like three kinds of dukkha. The pain of dukkha, 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 the pain of the unpleasant, the pain of having a body sometimes, or having a body that's sometimes the pain that arises in the body, the pain of injustice, the pain of, say, natural disasters that we're living through now, the ecological disasters that we're living through, and just the pain of afflictive heart mind states, right? The pain of pain. Then there's Viparinamadukkha, and this is just the experience of sometimes called the alternation between pleasant and unpleasant. It's not predictable, and we experience this as stressful, painful. And then there's Sankharadukkha. The Sankharadukkha. The unenlightened heart and mind sees it as weary or burdensome, nature of conditioned experience. It's just the recognition that because of impermanence, things are tending to disrepair, falling apart, being worn away, and it takes some effort on our part to keep things from disintegrating. And that weariness or that experience can be felt by an unawakened heart as stressful, wearisome. But it's for an awakened being, it's just the recognition of, yeah, we live in a fluid universe where things are completely changing all the time and things fall into disrepair because nothing lasts forever. That's the way it is. Like the unawakened heart knows, like, or the awakened heart recognizes, like, oh, this is samsara. Bodies age, they get injured, they are worn away by time, they die, they disintegrate. Pleasant experiences abate, And we know this intellectually, but the heart's like, but I don't want these pleasant experiences to pass away. I've just been thinking about, been listening to a scholar and an activist by the name of Loretta J. Ross. I think I told you all about her. Maybe it was last year. And she does a lot of, she does a lot of writing and speaking on call-out culture and cancel culture. Lovely, lovely being. She's an adjunct professor over at Smith right now, and she teaches a course on cancel culture and call-out culture. And she's been really working to, in her classrooms and in her community and even in her family, she's been working to build what's called the call-in culture. Well, holding people accountable, but from a place of love. This ethic of love, this recognition that there is innate goodness in everyone and you can call that forth. There's no need to shame and blame this culture of wokeness that is so well intended, but can be really harsh and divisive, harsh in its tone, the speech with which we practice wokeness can be so harsh, so shaming, so blaming. And she talks about forgiveness and learning. And in this age of like everything, almost everything is recorded. Like, what would it be like if your worst moment had been captured on tape and then suddenly, like, you risk losing your career or you're shamed and blamed publicly? Just, it seems like a really wholesome intention just gone wrong. So I've been reading a lot of her work and listening to her lectures. And she was talking about, and you may or may not agree, but she talks about we are in a struggle to protect this democracy that's still emerging. I really love that. Because it talks about democracy as a process, not something that's guaranteed. I know sometimes I feel really surprised at the state of the world. And I was like, no. Are you engaged? Are you tending to and upholding this process, this democratic process? Sankara dukkha. But if we don't tend to things, they start to disintegrate. The awakened mind isn't surprised by that. Unawakened mind goes, wait, what? Didn't we do this like 40, 50 years ago? Yeah, we gotta do it again. So the second noble truth concerns dukkha, and it's the dukkha of reactivity. Reactivity born of craving, of wanting things to be other than they are. And with the second noble truth, a wholesome that we're starting to trip toward, as I mentioned earlier, is just abandoning. Abandoning craving. And there are three kinds of craving that the Buddha encouraged us to abandon, to let go of. The first is craving for becoming. So sometimes it's talked about as a thirst, an unsatisfied longing for becoming, for existence. If you think about it, this is the thirst that fuels our rounds through samsara. So this birth and death, and the cycle of birth and death. And moving us through this sensory realm over and over again. This craving for sensory experience. It's what propels us through samsara. We all experience craving directly, right? We experience it when the mind is longing to be seen in a favorable light, or fantasizing about what we'll do or become in the future. And it's usually craving that fuels the process of wanting a favorable experience, right? Something that we like, something that's pleasant. And then when something is unpleasant, something that we don't want arises, then craving for existence abates. And the second form of craving comes in, craving for non-existence. This craving for things to come to an end. The heart and mind that wants to banish that which it deems as unpleasant, unfavorable from our lives. And then there's this third form of craving, craving for sensory experience. Pleasant sights and sounds and smells and tastes and sensations of the body. And we've talked about this before. There's this really striking, poignant simile that compares being beholden to pleasant sensory experience to being in financial debt. I say poignant because it's just a little sad. This craving for sensory experience, there's never enough. Our happiness is always outside of ourselves. To use this metaphor of being in financial debt, so we buy and we buy and we spend, but what we purchase doesn't satisfy this legitimate inner need for peace. Yeah, the peace that is our birthright. Pleasant sensory experience doesn't quite do it. Doesn't soothe that ache for peace. So we just get caught in the cycle of having to borrow from here and there just to get a little hit of pleasure that ultimately doesn't satisfy. It's so interesting with these three forms of craving, for becoming, for non-existence, for craving sensory experience. And some of you have probably recognized this, that we're not even wanting the experience. It's our idea about the experience that we're craving. What Andrea Fella calls craving story. And if you listen to craving story, yeah, if you're just mindful of it, you can hear like what it promises you, what the gratification is, what the hook is. And it's like, oh, maybe this time. And this is why the precepts are such a boon. Because when we're about to act on an unwholesome or an unskillful impulse, there's usually craving afoot, something that we're craving. And what's lovely about the precepts is we've made a commitment to restrain ourselves. And then when in that period of restraint, we can just bring mindfulness to the felt sense in the body, felt sense of what's arising in the heart mind, and actually notice like, oh, what is craving telling me? What's the lure? Oh, that's what it is. And you just feel it and allow it to move through you. So you're experiencing the mental action of craving, but that mental action isn't moving into your speech and your words, resulting in some unskillful action. And you also feel in how craving wants to use the body, fill our words to achieve a particular end. This is all made possible by when we really commit to the precepts. And where there's that moment of restraint, and we can turn to the heart and the body with mindfulness and know, like, oh, this is the story. Interesting. This is the story. And this is how craving wants to use my words. and this body to obtain what it thinks it wants. So all three forms of craving are fueled by ignorance, this deluded belief that our happiness comes if we accumulate as many positive experiences as possible and keep the what we deem as negative outside our sphere of experience. Our craving and ignorance fueling these rounds in samsara. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. For a long time, you've experienced the death of a dear one. That's not the language of the suttas. It goes through this whole list, but I just, in summary, that whole list is people that we really love. So for a long time, you've experienced the death of a dear one, the loss of relatives, the loss of wealth, loss through illness. And just think of this global pandemic, all the loss. As you've experienced this weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the stream of tears that you have shed is more than the waters in the four great oceans. For what reason? Because this samsara is without a discoverable beginning. A first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Never thought of that, as craving as a fetter, that which binds us to samsara. It is enough to experience disenchantment towards all formations, no longer being under the spell of craving, waking up to like, oh, that's the promise. But that ain't gonna be the outcome. I've seen this many, many, many times. Right? And seeing through craving story and the spell that it casts on us. It is enough to experience disenchantment towards all formations. Enough to become dispassionate towards them. Enough to be liberated from them. Craving and ignorance runs really deep. It's probably one of the reasons why it takes a great deal of energy and many, 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 many lifetimes to fully awaken. And as we've talked about before, what Gil Fronsdale calls the biological imperative for freedom runs deeper than craving and ignorance, or else freedom wouldn't actually be possible. But just to remind you of how Gil frames this biological imperative, he says that somehow the depth, the core of what this Dhamma practice is about, it's not up to you. Sometimes I take delight in that. It's like, phew. Okay. I'm not in control of this process. I can just surrender and do the practice. But something's going to be working through you. And it's nothing mystical. It's not like coming from outside. It's a potential, a possibility that lives in your own heart, the biological imperative for freedom. So this third noble truth, the biological imperative for freedom, this terrain of a liberated heart, what our hearts start to trope towards in this third noble truth is making freedom, realizing freedom, making freedom real, not only like making it real, but recognizing when it's present. So I just supported a course that Venerable Inalio was teaching. And during one of the breaks, one of the other assistants asked, Venerable, are there any living beings who are free and liberated right now? Like we've, and you can hear in the question, this sincere practitioner who's like been reading all these suttas and Everybody was waking up every couple of seconds. And is there anyone now? Is this possible for us now? And Venerable was so clear. He just, yes. He said there are beings that he's met who are fully liberated, free, or have experienced some degree of freedom. So here's how the suttas describe the third noble truth. Now, this is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving of the second noble truth was pointing to. The giving up and relinquishing of craving, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. So a person who is said to be free of craving, they're described as a sage at peace, unshaken, unagitated, hungerless, extinguished, cooled, experiencing bliss. A sage at peace, not shaken, unshakable, not agitated, hungerless, extinguished, cooled, experiencing bliss. You can feel just the felt sense in the difference between this third noble truth and the agitation that's inherent in craving. Being off balance, leaning forward, leaning back from experience. The sage at peace, steady, unshaken like a mountain, still in touch with experience, still knowing dukkha, still knowing all kinds of dukkha, not agitated, hungerless, extinguished, cooled, experiencing bliss. The sutta goes on. Since they do not generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being, no karma, they do not cling to anything in this world. When they do not cling, they are not agitated. When they are not agitated, they personally attain nibbana. So nibbana as this non-agitation. Now, out of the activity of craving, and remember that craving is just the shorthand for the interplay of greed, aversion, and delusion. Now, out of the activity of craving, we cling to our ideas of experience. The sutta goes on. A remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. There's this really beautiful a couple of lines at the end of the frame in the Satipatthana Sutta. Anicito cha viharati. One abides independent, not relying on craving. Freedom from craving, non-reliance on craving. Anachikinchi loke padyati. So not clinging to anything in the world. One abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. It's the beauty of the Satipatthana Sutta. It's helping us to live into this. I could live without craving. And then noticing those moments when we do. And the peace, the lack of agitation, the coolness, the unshakability. Since they do not generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being, they do not cling to anything in the world. When they do not cling, they are not agitated. When they are not agitated, they personally attain nibbana. And we've all had this experience, whether it's practicing with the four Satipatthanas, or you're out on a walk, just resting in choiceless attention. Pain can arise in the body, but there isn't the fixation and the clinging around it and all of the proliferation that can come with that. We've all had these moments of feeling clinging release and the relief of that. Ashram Buddha Dasa talks about this as temporary nibbana. See what he says about it. Any reactive emotions that arises ceases when its causes and conditions are finished. Although it may be a temporary quenching, merely a temporary coolness, it is still nibbana, even if only temporarily. Thus, there's a temporary nibbana for those who can't yet avoid some defilement. Anyone can see that if the egoistic emotions existed night and day without any pause or rest, no life could endure. If such a life didn't die, it would go crazy and then die in the end. You ought to consider carefully the fact that life can only survive because there are periods when the defilements don't roast us. There are these periods where craving and clinging release. These periods outnumber the times when the defilements blaze. And notice that he uses this image of fire, of heat around defilements. These periods outnumber the times when the defilements blaze. When you're with that second noble truth and you're noticing craving, does it have a heat to it? Is there a fiery quality in the clinging, in the agitation? When there's a release, when it abates, is there a coolness, steadiness, unshakability? Sage at peace, or peacefulness that allows wisdom to move through the heart, permeating our words and our actions, that we're actually blessing each other and blessing our own hearts. Fourth noble truth. With this fourth noble truth, Buddha was so thorough. He was so thorough. It would have been cool if he just gave us the first three. But he was like, no, I'm going to show you the way. These are the eight things you got to do. These are the eight things that'll like move you solidly into the direction of awakening. It was beautiful. Again, these noble truths are filled with compassion, filled with the Buddha's care for our happiness and welfare. And I know he's not alive now, but it's said in the suttas that he practiced, that he taught out of care and concern for the welfare of those who were his contemporaries and for future generations. That's us. So with the four noble truths, or this fourth noble truth, so thorough, what the heart is starting to trip towards is this path that leads to awakening that is to be developed. And we embark on it by understanding the path factors related to wisdom. And that understanding then supports us in living into sila, a heart that's ethically attuned, ethically sensitive. And sila's talked about in a few ways in terms of character. The suttas talk about being who possesses, filled with virtue, a heart of virtue. Talked about in terms of ethical guidelines. It's also talked about in terms of, what's the third one I'm forgetting? I don't remember the third one. But this understanding of wisdom supports us in like Okay. I'm gonna live into wise speech and wise action and livelihood that doesn't cause harm to other beings. I'm currently working with someone right now who has a job that is really harmful to people, actually. And it's sanctioned by our government. It's quite harmful. And as she's practiced, she's coming to the recognition of, like, I can't do this anymore. The wisdom of her own heart and her compassion sees, like, when I engage in this, I'm actually planting seeds for harm in the world. I don't want to be a part of this anymore. A wise livelihood. And then there are the three factors of the path that are around meditative development. So wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And the Noble Eightfold Path isn't some like heavy responsibility that we have to take up and like trudge our way through. It's just listen how the Buddha characterizes the Noble Eightfold Path. He says a safe and good path to be traveled joyfully. Not woefully, joyfully. The safe and good path to be traveled joyfully is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path. That is right view, right intention, wisdom factors of the path. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Sila portion of the sila factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Meditative development. So, bhikkhus, the safe and good path to be traveled joyfully has been reopened by me. Again, there's the compassion. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. Let's just let the word settle and sit for just a moment.